trial grounds for price targeting strategies because they don't leak. The really great pricing tricks take place on airlines, in restaurants and cocktail bars. Not many bookstores have a happy hour. In supermarkets and at tourist attractions. In contrast, some products are inherently leaky. They're expensive, easy to transport, and non-perishable. The obvious examples are digital media, CDs, DVDs, and software, and pharmaceuticals. Companies go to tremendous lengths to plug leaks, which in an age where internet shopping allows us to order products from anywhere in the world, are becoming increasingly difficult to prevent. For instance, the DVD industry agreed on a system of regional coding so that DVDs bought in the United States would not work in Europe. But that system is being circumvented by an alliance of customers and DVD machine suppliers who willingly equip machines to read a DVD from anywhere in the world. If your instincts are anything like mine, it all seems like a pretty shabby trick. But the same popular opinion that despises the DVD industry for trying to sell their products at different prices in different markets also believes that the big pharmaceutical companies should supply drugs to poor countries at discounted prices. Confusingly, our moral intuitions seem to be sending us contradictory messages. Maybe the story is as simple as this. When it's an important product, like a treatment for HIV, AIDS, the most important thing is to get it to the poor. When it's as trivial as a DVD, our irritation at being ripped off is the dominant emotion. But that doesn't quite add up. DVDs make it to very poor areas, and surely we should be at least somewhat pleased that the poor get to watch movies in bars and village halls across the developing world? Or, conversely, shouldn't we be even more outraged that the pharmaceutical companies are overcharging for crucial treatments in the developed world? An economist cannot solve these ethical conundrums, but economics can unwrap them so that at least the ethical question becomes clearer. When price targeting is a good thing. Here is a thought experiment. Imagine a hypothetical pharmaceutical company called PillCor, which has developed a uniquely powerful new treatment for HIV/AIDS. Assume that it doesn't engage in any price targeting and charges the same price across the globe. PillCor will set the global price so that the gain in sales from cutting the price exactly balances the loss of margin from a price cut. For example, say that PillCor cut prices and reduced their margins by half. Unless they doubled sales, this would reduce profits. They could raise prices and double their margins, but if sales dropped by more than half, that would also reduce profits. PillCor will maximize profits by pricing at the point where either a price cut or a price increase would slightly damage the bottom line. The price will be high because people in rich countries will pay a lot for an effective treatment, and there is no point in losing customers who are paying thousands of dollars in an effort to pick up customers who are paying pennies. That looks like bad news. PillCor is using its scarcity power to charge a high price for a life-saving drug. As a result, people in poor countries don't get the drug. People are dying because of PillCor's greed. Actually, it's only half bad news. People are also living because of PillCor's greed. PillCor developed the life-saving treatment because it was encouraged to do so by the hope of a lucrative patent. Pharmaceuticals are very expensive to research and develop, and somebody has to pay the bill. The current system is that public and private insurers pay, and since the United States is easily the largest market, innovation is driven by and largely paid for there. Although PillCor is making money by selling its drug at a high uniform global price, they could be doing better, and so could everybody else. Economists don't just have in mind, a shrug your shoulders, life's like that sometimes, could be better. We mean something more precise. PillCor could be making more money and serving the world better. Say that a year's supply of drugs for one customer costs $10 for PillCorp to produce and retails at $1,000. For rich customers willing to pay, or who have insurance that will pay, that's not really a problem. Each year of treatment transfers $990 from those living with AIDS to those who produced the treatment. But a taxi driver in Cameroon might be willing to pay only $50 a year for treatment. Beyond that, he'd rather buy food or gas for his taxi. Because of PillCorp's global price policy, the taxi driver loses out on the treatment, and PillCorp loses out on the chance to make some profit. But if PillCorp were able to make a one-time discount to the taxi driver and sell him the treatment for any price between $10 and $50, say $30, everybody would be better off. The taxi driver gets treatment for $30 when he was willing to pay $50. PillCorp receives $30 in revenues for a $10 pill, a profit of $20. That is what economists mean when we say a situation could be better. If we can point to a change that could make at least one person better off and nobody worse off, we say that the current situation is inefficient, or in everyday language, that it could be better. We also say that the current situation is efficient if every change that could make at least one person better off will also make somebody else worse off. It doesn't mean that an efficient situation can't be improved. It's just that there is no costless way to improve it. Now, imagine that PillCorp practices price targeting, continuing to charge $1,000 in rich Western countries, but supplying people in developing countries, like the Cameroon taxi driver, for $30. Suddenly, a whole new market opens up for PillCorp. The new discount allows the company to acquire millions of new customers at a profit of $20 a year, but at the same time, it still makes all the sales it used to make in rich countries. This assumes the cheap pills don't leak back, which in practice is a massive concern for pharmaceutical companies. The current leakage of cheap drugs from Canada is a problem for drug companies who want to take advantage of the high willingness to pay in the United States, but who also sell to Canadian healthcare providers who refuse to pay high prices for drugs. The risk, if the leakage continues, is that American providers simply refuse to offer discounts to Canada anymore. The example should also make us realize that the greater price transparency brought about by the Internet and other improvements in communications occasionally has a downside. A company with scarcity power may be discouraged from offering discounted products because they are more likely to leak. PillCorp's dual pricing policy creates a much better situation. Customers in rich countries are no worse off. Shareholders in PillCorp are better off. And people living with HIV/AIDS in poor countries are also better off. To use the business school jargon, this is a win-win situation, or, as an economist would say, a clear improvement in efficiency. This doesn't mean the new situation is perfect. It just means that it is unambiguous progress from the previous situation where PillCorp's scarcity power was causing a huge inefficiency and huge loss of life in poor countries. Perhaps we are outraged to see the poor denied drugs that cost pennies to produce, not because that is unfair. Many things are unfair, but because it is also so wasteful of life. When price targeting is a bad thing. PillCorp's new price targeting program was a win-win affair. But sometimes price targeting is a losing proposition all around. Consider another hypothetical organization, TrainCorp, a passenger train company. TrainCorp owns a train that always travels full. Some of the seats go at a discount of $50 to leisure travelers who booked in advance, to senior citizens, to students, or to families. The other tickets cost the full price of $100 and are bought by commuters and other business travelers. This is a fairly standard group targeting strategy. By giving away a few low-price tickets, Train Corps restricts supply and acquires the ability to demand high prices by offering tickets to only the buyers with the highest willingness to pay. It might be profitable for Train Corps just to fence off some of the seats and restrict supply that way, but it's even better for them to fill the spare seats if they can. We know at once, if we are economists, that this is inefficient. In other words, we can think of something that would make at least one person better off without making anyone else worse off. That something is to find a commuter who was willing to pay a little less than $100, say $95, and who decided to travel by car instead, and offer him a seat for $90. Where does the seat come from since the train is full? Well, you take a student who is in no great hurry and was willing to pay a little more than $50, say $55, for the seat, and politely throw him off the train. But you refund the price of his ticket plus an extra $10 for his trouble. Where do we stand now? The commuter was willing to pay $95, but only paid $90. He's better off by $5. The student was willing to pay $55 for a $50 ticket, so if he'd been allowed to ride, he'd have been only $5 better off. But he has just been given $10, so the student is also happy. And what about Train Corps? Well, Train Corps just transformed a $50 ticket into a $90 ticket and made a more profitable sale. Even after paying $10 compensation to the student, the company is $30 ahead. Now everyone's a winner. Or they would be if Train Corps adopted this system instead of its group price-targeting strategy. But of course, that's not what happens, because if Train Corps tried it, commuters who were willing to pay $100 would hang around for the $90 tickets, and students who weren't willing to pay $50 would buy tickets anyway and wait to be paid to get off. The whole affair would turn out badly for Train Corps, who is the one who gets to set the prices. In case your head is spinning a little, here's the quick and dirty summary. The group price targeting strategy is inefficient because it takes seats away from customers who are willing to pay more and gives them to customers who are willing to pay less. Yet airlines and railroads still use it because the alternative of individual price targeting isn't feasible. Okay, so sometimes price targeting is less efficient than a uniform price, as in the case of the train. Sometimes it's more efficient than a uniform price, as in the case of HIV/AIDS drugs. But we can say more than that. Whenever price targeting fails to expand the number of sales and merely moves products from people who value them more, like commuters, to people who value them less, like students, as in the case of Train Corps, it will definitely be less efficient than a uniform price. Whenever price targeting opens up a new market without affecting the old market, as with PILCOR, it will definitely be more efficient than a uniform price. And there's a middle position. A lot of group price targeting does a bit of both. It opens up some new markets, but also wastefully moves products away from high-value users to low-value users. For example, this book is published in hardcover at a high price, and then the paperback edition emerges later at a lower price. The aim is to target a higher price at people impatient to hear what I have to say and at libraries. One good result is that the publisher will be able to sell paperbacks more cheaply, because some costs will be offset by the hardcover sales, and so the book will reach more people. One bad result is that the early version is much more expensive than it would be if there was only a single paperback edition, and some buyers will be put off. That's what life is like in a world of scarcity. When companies with scarcity power try to exploit it, the situation will almost always be inefficient and, equivalently, we economists will almost always be able to think of something better. I say almost, because a company which is able to practice perfectly individualized price targeting strategy would never miss a sale. Rich or desperate customers would pay a lot, poor or indifferent customers would pay very little, but no customer willing to pay the cost of production would be turned away. The situation would be efficient. Being realistic, though, it's most unlikely that any company would have so much information about its customers as to be able to make such perfectly efficient sales. The company would need to peer into the heart of every possible customer and find out how badly he or she wanted the product. It would need a supercomputer to operate the cash registers. That just isn't plausible. But perhaps it makes you think. What if you could plug every customer's preferences into a supercomputer? What if you had all the information you needed to never miss a sale? Would the world be a better place? Something else may have caught your attention. When Pilcor changed its global pricing policy, it did something that was not only profitable, but also both efficient and fair. Can we say anything more generally about when private greed will serve the public interest? For the answers to all these questions, and more, read on. Chapter 3. Perfect Markets and the World of Truth. You might not expect Jim Carrey films and economics to have much in common. But in fact, there is much we can learn from the rubber-faced comedian. Consider the film Liar Liar, which tells the story of Fletcher Reed. As a result of his son's birthday wish, Fletcher Reed finds that he is compelled to tell the truth for 24 hours. This is problematic for Fletcher, because he is a lawyer. Or a liar, as his son understands it. And hilarity predictably ensues as a horrified Fletcher incriminates himself by helplessly blurting out truthful answers to every question he is asked. They don't make as much of a feel-good movie, but free markets are just like Fletcher Reed's son. They force you to tell the truth. Yet while the results were humiliating for Jim Carrey's character, we will discover that a world of truth leads to a perfectly efficient economy, one in which it is impossible to make someone better off without making someone else worse off. In this chapter, we'll see what truth means in economic terms, how it leads to efficiency, and why efficiency is good. We'll also explore efficiency's shortcomings, how efficiency isn't always fair, and why we have taxes. As we'll see, taxes are like lies. They interfere with the world of truth. But I'll reveal one way in which taxes can be implemented which is both fair and efficient. This could be good news for seniors struggling to pay their winter heating bills, but bad news for Tiger Woods. Imagine, if you will, that Fletcher's son gets his birthday wish, not just for his smooth-talking dad, but for the whole world. So, let's buy a cappuccino in the world of truth. Before frothing up the half and half for you, the barista looks you up and down and asks, "What's the most you're willing to pay for this coffee?" You'd like to lie and pretend that you don't really want it, but the truth just slips out. "I'm in caffeine withdrawal. $15. With a smirk, the barista prepares to ring up the extortionate sum, but you have a few questions of your own. How much did those coffee beans cost? How much did you pay for the plastic lid and the cup? How much does it cost to raise a cow? And how much milk can you get from one? How much did the electricity cost for the refrigeration, heating, and light in here?" Now it is the barista's turn to have a Fletcher Reed moment. No matter how she tries to evade the questions or froth up the cost of the cappuccino, she cannot tell a lie. It turns out that the cappuccino costs not $15, but less than one. The barista tries to haggle, but you have one more killer question. "Are any other places within 30 yards selling coffee like this?" "Yes," she moans, her head thudding to the counter in a gesture of abject defeat. You walk out of the shop with the coffee safely in your possession for the bargain price of 92 cents. Prices are optional, which means they reveal information. There's a basic truth incorporated into any system of prices. That truth comes from the fact that stores and consumers do not have to buy or sell at a given price. They can always opt out. If you'd been willing to pay only 50 cents for the coffee, nobody could have forced you to raise your offer or forced the barista to drop the price. The sale simply would not have occurred. Of course, you sometimes hear people complaining that if they want something, say an apartment on Central Park West, then they have to pay the exorbitant asking price. That's true. But although prices sometimes seem unfairly high, you hardly ever have to pay them. You could always use your money to buy an apartment in Harlem, or a house in Newark, or a million cups of coffee instead. In a free market, people don't buy things that are worth less to them than the asking price. And people don't sell things that are worth more to them than the asking price. Or if they do, it's never for long. Firms that routinely sell cups of coffee for half of what they cost to produce will go out of business pretty quickly. The reason is simple. Nobody is forcing them to, which means that most transactions that happen in a free market improve efficiency because they make both parties better off, or at least not worse off, and don't harm anyone else. Now you can begin to see why I say that prices tell the truth and reveal information. In a free market, all the buyers of coffee would prefer to have coffee than the money the coffee cost, which is shorthand for saying they prefer coffee to whatever else they might have spent 92 cents on. That is, the value of the product to the customer is equal to or higher than the price, and the cost to the producer equal to or lower than the price. Painfully obvious, perhaps, but the implications turn out to be dramatic. It may seem trivial to say that in a free market, we know customers value coffee more than the money they pay for it. Yet it's not quite as trivial as it looks. For a start, this trivial piece of information is already more than we can say about anything that is paid for outside the market. For example, Washington, D.C.'s hugely controversial new baseball stadium. The Montreal Expos baseball team agreed to move to D.C. on the condition that the D.C. government subsidize the cost of a new stadium. Some say the subsidy will be $70 million, others that it will be far higher. Maybe this is a good idea, and maybe not. It's not clear how we decide whether this is a good way of spending taxpayers' money. When decisions are made inside a market system, there's no such controversy. If I decide to pay $70 for a ticket to see a baseball game, nobody questions whether it's worth it. I made my choice, so obviously I thought so. This free choice produces information about my priorities and preferences, and when millions of us make choices, market prices aggregate the priorities and preferences of us all. Perfect markets. The truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. So, the trivial piece of information that in a free market customers value cappuccinos more than the money they pay for them is not so trivial after all. But we needn't stop there. Imagine now that the coffee market is not only free but extremely competitive, that entrepreneurs are always starting new firms with fresh ideas and entering the market in an attempt to undercut the incumbent companies. Profits in a competitive industry are high enough only to pay workers and persuade entrepreneurs that their money isn't better off in a savings account, no higher. The competition will force the price of coffee down to the marginal cost the coffee bar incurs when making one more cappuccino, which we may remember is just under a dollar. In a perfectly competitive market, the price of coffee would equal the marginal cost of coffee. If the price were lower, firms would go out of business until it rose. If the price were higher, new firms would enter or old firms would expand their output until it fell. Suddenly, the price is not conveying a vague fact. This coffee is worth 92 cents or more to the buyer and it cost the coffee bar 92 cents or less, but a precise truth. This coffee cost the coffee bar exactly 92 cents. What if other industries were also perfectly competitive? That would mean that for every product, the price equaled the marginal cost. Every product would be linked to every other product through an ultra-complex network of prices. So when something changes somewhere in the economy, there's a frost in Brazil or a craze for iPods in the US, everything else would change, maybe imperceptibly, maybe a lot, to adjust. A frost in Brazil, for example, would damage the coffee crop and reduce the worldwide supply of coffee. This would increase the price coffee roasters have to pay to a level that discourages enough coffee drinking to offset the shortfall. Demand for alternative products, like tea, would rise a little, encouraging higher tea prices and extra supply of tea. Demand for complementary products like coffee creamer would fall a little. In Kenya, coffee farmers would enjoy bumper profits and would invest the money in improvements like aluminum roofing for their houses. The price of aluminum would rise, and so some farmers would decide to wait before buying. That means demand for bank accounts and safety deposit boxes would rise, although for unfortunate farmers in Brazil with their failed crops, the opposite may be happening. The free market supercomputer processes the truth about demands and about costs, and gives people the incentive to respond in astonishingly intricate ways. That may seem like a ridiculous hypothetical scenario, but economists can measure and have measured some of these effects. When frosts hit Brazil, world coffee prices do indeed rise. Kenyan farmers do buy aluminum roofing. The price of roofing does rise, and the farmers do, in fact, time their investment so that they don't pay too much. Even if markets are not perfect, they can convey tremendously complex information. Governments, or any organizations, find it hard to respond to such complex information. In Tanzania, coffee is not produced in a free market, and the government, rather than the farmers, receives any windfalls from high coffee prices. Historically, the government has failed to spend the money sensibly, blowing too much on unsustainable salary rises for civil servants, and failing to realize that the price spike was temporary. To appreciate why markets do such a good job of processing complex information, first think about the customer. We know that he won't buy a cappuccino unless he values it more than anything else he could buy with the same money. But what else could he buy with the same money? In our world of truth, he could buy anything that costs the same as or less than a cappuccino. If he chooses the coffee, he is saying that of all things in the world that cost the same as coffee, he would like coffee to be made. Elsewhere, of course, there are other people spending their money not on coffee, but on movie tickets, bus fares, or underwear. And there are others choosing not to spend their money at all, and to put it in the bank instead. All of these competing demands pull producers to respond. If people want computers, then manufacturers will build factories, hire workers, and buy plastics and metals, which will be diverted from other uses to go into computers. If people want coffee instead of underwear, then more land will be devoted to coffee and less to other uses, like parks or housing or tobacco farming. Lingerie shops will be replaced by coffee shops. Of course, startup companies will borrow money from banks, and interest rates will rise or fall depending on the balance between the number of people wanting to save and the number of people wanting to borrow. Interest rates are just another price, the price of spending today instead of next year. You might have thought that interest rates were set by central bankers like Alan Greenspan at the Federal Reserve or Mervyn King at the Bank of England. Actually, Greenspan and King chair committees that set nominal interest rates. True interest rates are interest rates after inflation, set by the market in response to the central bankers. The changes don't stop there. The ripples in the price system continue outward. They whip through some parts of the economy at tremendous speed and cause slow but powerful seismic shifts in others, like education or technology. For example, if there aren't enough trained workers to produce computers, manufacturers like Dell and Compaq will have to train them, or raise wages to poach them from other manufacturers like Apple and Gateway. As the wages for skilled workers rise, people will see that it's worth taking time off and paying to go to college. Manufacturers' interest in producing cheaper or better computers will give a boost to research labs and engineering schools. Higher demand for plastics will raise the price of the raw material, crude oil, which will in turn encourage those who use oil for energy to switch to cheaper substitute fuels or to invest in energy-saving technology. And so it continues. Some of these effects will be tiny. Others will be enormous. Some will have an instant effect. Others will not be realized for decades. But in the world of truth, the world of perfect markets, all of them will have an impact. What is the result of a set of perfectly competitive markets interconnected like this? Companies are making things the right way. Any company that wastes resources, overproduces, or uses the wrong technology will go out of business. Every product is produced in the most efficient way. Companies are making the right things. The price of a product equals the cost to make it. The price also reflects the terms at which customers can trade off one priority against another. Two cups of coffee cost the same as one Danish. Which would you prefer? The price is a direct line of communication from what products cost to what customers prefer and back again. Things are being made in the right proportions. If too much coffee were being produced, manufacturers would cut prices, and if too little, prices would rise. Either way, the situation would correct itself. In the competitive market, price equals cost. There is no incentive for anyone to produce less, giving up profitable sales, or to produce more, creating products that cost more than anyone is willing to pay. The competitive rule, price equals cost equals value to the consumer, keeps things efficient. Things are going to the right people. The only people who buy products are the people who are willing to pay the appropriate price. Let's say I confiscate a cappuccino from Axel and give it to Bob. In the world of truth, this is wasteful. Axel was willing to pay for coffee and Bob was not, which means Axel values coffee more than Bob, and my confiscation is inefficient. Notice that here I am equating right with efficient, an assumption we'll examine and challenge shortly. So, if the right things are being made right in the right quantities and going to the people who value them most, there is no room for any gains in efficiency. To put it another way, you can't get more efficient than a perfectly competitive market. And it all follows perfectly naturally from the truth contained in the price system. Prices are true representations of cost to firms and also true representations of value to customers. Life without markets. Because Western society relies heavily on free markets, we find it difficult to imagine what it would be like if we didn't, or to take a step back and see quite how profound the effect of the market is. Yet any modern democracy provides goods outside the market system, and looking at the way such goods are provided gives us a hint of the strengths and weaknesses of markets. Think of your friendly local police force, which is paid for by a non-market system of taxation. The non-market system has some advantages. For one thing, when you dial 911, nobody asks for your credit card details. The government is supposed to afford the same level of protection to the rich and poor, although it does not always seem that way. But the non-market system also has some disadvantages. For instance, if a police officer is rude or incompetent, you don't have the option to shop for a different police force. If you think that the level of police protection you receive is excessive, it's not up to you to cut back a bit. Neither can you spend more if you decide that you'd like extra service. No, you have to lobby your local politicians and hope they consider your demands. Government-provided schooling is another example of a non-market service that many of us use. In both Britain and the United States, most people send their children to government-funded schools. But those schools are different from each other, different atmospheres, different academic emphases. Most importantly, some are good schools and some are not. The market solution for schools is similar to the market solution for food. The best food goes to the people who are willing, which also implies able, to pay most for it. But within the government sector there are no prices. What happens instead? Parents line up, haggle, and protest. They move to districts with better schools. In Britain, government-run religious schools often have the best academic records, so atheists take their children to church every Sunday in order to get good references from priests and get their children into these schools. As with the police, the non-market system has the cozy advantage of concealing the fact that the poor don't get the same quality of education that the rich do. But again, the non-market system suffers from a serious problem. The truth about values, costs, and benefits has disappeared. It is impossible to tell which parents enroll their children in church schools for religious reasons and which parents are just looking for better results. It is also impossible to know how much parents would be willing to pay for more teachers and better materials. In a market system, the truth would emerge about how much it costs to provide good schools and who would be willing to pay for them. The non-market system struggles with these basic questions. It seems that there is a willingness to pay for good schools, and we see it emerge because house prices are higher in the areas of schools with the best reputation. The non-market system, which gives preference to local children, channels the money that parents are willing to pay for a good school into the hands of property owners near existing good schools. This hardly seems sensible. A market system would simply direct the money to pay for more good schools. The signalling function of prices. Prices perform two functions, not just one. In a market system, prices provide a way of deciding who gets to enjoy a limited supply of schools. Whoever pays most gets to send their children to the best schools, an uncomfortable state of affairs, which the government school system is designed to prevent. But prices also give the signal to build more schools, hire more teachers, or raise their wages if they're in short supply, and buy better materials. In the longer term, a price system will transform a high willingness to pay for good schools into a lot of good schools, just as surely as it will transform a high demand for coffee into a lot of cappuccino. Don't politicians know that we value good schools already? Should they be making government money available? The difficulty is that politicians hear that we want good schools, but they also hear that we want more police on the streets, a better health service, lots of big roads, excellent welfare benefits, low taxes, and a double-shot caramel venti latte. It's easy for us to demand all of these things, but prices, by forcing us to put money where our mouths are, uncover the truth. Taxes have their advantages, but many don't contribute to truth because we cannot choose whether or not to pay them, depending on whether each penny is spent according to our wishes. Because prices are optional, they reveal information. None of this amounts to a knockdown argument against providing a police service or a school system with a non-market process. Non-market systems have their advantages, but they also lose something important. Information. Information about wants, needs, and desires, and about inconveniences and costs. Sometimes the loss of information is worthwhile because it is offset by gains in equality or stability. But sometimes the loss of information can leave an economy and a society floundering in waste and confusion. We think that the value we get from schools and police are more than what they cost us in taxes, but we don't know for sure. Not so with the cappuccino. Efficiency versus fairness. Can we handle the truth? A perfectly competitive market is like a giant supercomputer network. With amazing processing power and sensors in every part of the economy, reaching even inside our brains to read our desires, the market is constantly re-optimizing production and allocating the results perfectly. Remember that when economists say the economy is inefficient, they mean that there's a way to make somebody better off without harming anybody else. While the perfectly competitive market is perfectly efficient, efficiency is not enough to ensure a fair society or even a society in which we would want to live. After all, it is efficient if Bill Gates has all the money and everybody else starves to death. Because there's no way to make anybody better off without making Bill Gates worse off. We need something more than efficiency. So, it's hardly surprising we sometimes prefer the cozy white lies. It is expensive, for example, to heat the house of an elderly lady in Minnesota. But we may prefer to subsidize the fuel, not wanting her to face the truth of that expense. Even more than subsidies, taxes are a common cause of inefficiency. The government taxes market transactions and spends the money on, we hope, good things like police forces and schools. Why are taxes inefficient? Because they destroy the information carried by prices in perfectly competitive, efficient markets. Price no longer equals cost, so cost no longer equals value. For example, a sales tax of 10% creates a lie in the following circumstances. Cost of cappuccino, 90 cents. Price of cappuccino in perfectly competitive market, 90 cents. Price of cappuccino after tax, 99 cents. Willingness to pay for cappuccino, 95 cents. Cappuccino sold, none. Tax raised, zero. There was a sale that could have created 5 cents of efficiency gains. Cappuccino cost 90 cents, but was valued at 95 cents, but which never happened because of the tax. What's worse, the tax wasn't even paid. If the government were able to waive the tax in such circumstances, they would be no worse off, but the coffee buyer would be better off. A clear efficiency gain. It's hard for tax officials to know when to charge the tax, situations where taxes will not change buyers' behavior, and when to waive the tax, because potential buyers would have avoided it anyway by not buying coffee. But they try to do so using the kind of price-targeting strategies outlined in Chapter 2. Taxes are often higher when price sensitivity is low. For example, the government charges high taxes on gasoline and cigarettes, not for environmental and health reasons, but because people who buy these products need to drive and are addicted to smoking. They won't change their behavior much, even in the face of large taxes. We are faced with a dilemma. We want to avoid inefficiency because that would leave us passing up an opportunity to make somebody better off at no cost to anyone else. But taxes cause inefficiency, and most of us think we need taxes to redistribute income, to a greater or lesser extent, from the rich to the poor. We seem to be facing two contradictory imperatives. Avoid the needless waste that is inefficiency, but make sure that wealth is at least somewhat evenly spread. What we need is a way to make our economies both efficient and fair. Can we enlist markets to help with fairness? Is it true that we have to choose between the efficiency of perfect markets and the fairness of benevolent government intervention? This seemed to be the conclusion of governments throughout the free world after the experience of the Great Depression and World War II. President Roosevelt's New Deal programs of the 1930s expanded the role of the United States government in response to the Great Depression. In Britain, Clement Attlee's post-war government took control of much of the health, steel, air travel, petroleum, rail travel, and telephone industries. Government-owned businesses took over partly because in the deprived, exhausted, yet hopeful years after the war, economists had some confidence in the experts who had masterminded the war effort and thought they might not do a bad job of organizing the economy efficiently. Few people foresaw the later collapse of government-run economies, whether vast, like the Soviet Union and China, or small, like Tanzania or North Korea. But even if they had believed that private markets were more efficient, this was neither here nor there in the 1940s. The post-war Labour government in Britain would have been content to live with some inefficiency if it meant a fairer society. But the old dilemma between efficiency and fairness was about to be shattered by a young New Yorker called Kenneth Arrow, who knew all about unfairness after watching helplessly as a teenager while his father lost his successful business and all his savings in the Great Depression. The desire for social justice stayed with Arrow, but intellectually he couldn't just ignore the question of efficiency. The young economist set his logical mind to wrestling with the tension between the unerring efficiency of the free market and the imperative that some kind of fairness should prevail. His solution was brilliant, twisting the traditional thinking about competitive markets and efficiency on its head. He proved that not only are all perfect markets efficient, all efficient outcomes can be achieved using a competitive market by adjusting the starting position. Arrow went on to win every plaudit available to an economist, and he remains the youngest man ever to win the Nobel Prize for Economics. But why was his insight so important? I call it the Head Start Theorem. Instead of focusing on the enormous complexity of a real economy, think of a very simple one-dimensional human challenge, the 100-meter sprint. The fastest sprinter will win the race. If you wanted all the sprinters to cross the line together, you could just change the rules of the race, ordering the fast runners to slow down and everyone to hold hands as they crossed the line. A waste of talent. Or you could move some starting blocks forward and some starting blocks back, so that although each sprinter was running as fast as he could, obeying the usual rules and objectives of sprinting, the fastest had to cover enough extra ground that he would end up breaking the tape neck and neck with the slowest. Arrow demonstrated that the same approach could work when trying to balance the excesses of competitive markets. Instead of interfering with the markets themselves, the trick is to adjust the starting blocks by making lump-sum payments and levying one-time taxes. An example of a lump-sum tax would be the government taxing everybody $800. Or, alternatively, taxing everyone over the age of 65 $800. Or, alternatively, taxing everybody whose surname on the birth certificate starts with H $800. The point is that unlike an income tax or a sales tax on coffee, a lump sum tax doesn't affect anybody's behavior because there is nothing you can do to avoid it. So unlike sales tax, it doesn't lead to an efficiency loss. Similarly, an example of lump sum redistribution would be to give $800 to everybody whose name starts with H, a policy for which I would be happy to vote. In the 100-meter sprint, lump-sum taxation is like moving the starting blocks back a few paces. Income tax and sales tax are like asking the best runners to run backwards. Both would have the effect of ensuring a more equal finish, but moving the starting blocks around doesn't slow anybody down. In the context of a sprint, it's fairly obvious that one of the ways to get a close result is to give the slower runners a head start. In the context of an economy, with literally billions of different goods, desires, raw materials, and talents, the Head Start theorem is a much bolder claim. But it's true, you can allow the competitive economy to use every skill and every raw material, take advantage of every opportunity to trade, cooperate, educate, or invest, but still get a fair outcome by moving around the starting blocks and letting perfect markets do the rest. The implication is that in a world of perfect markets, the only thing needed to ensure both fairness and efficiency is a Head Start strategy. A program of appropriate lump sum taxes and subsidies that puts everyone on equal footing. The perfect market then finds every possible opportunity to make everybody better off from their revised starting points. The question is, can this be done in practice? Impractical examples. Let's take an example. American political philosopher Robert Nozick deployed a famous argument against taking a view of justice as fairness. In other words, he disputed the notion that one particular allocation of wealth could be deemed the best or fair allocation. Nozick's argument invokes Wilt Chamberlain, a basketball star famous in the 1960s and 70s, when Nozick was writing. Chamberlain's talents made him wealthy. Nozick felt this was just, because Chamberlain's wealth was the outcome of legitimate decisions by fans happy to pay to see him play. The situation may have been just in Nozick's sense of the word, but can any situation that leads to a highly unequal distribution of cash be considered fair? Perhaps taxing Chamberlain's income heavily would make the situation fairer. But Nozick warns that if Chamberlain did not really enjoy playing basketball, and he was loaded down with heavy taxes, he might stop playing altogether. So although this situation might seem more fair, there would be neither the tax revenue nor the basketball game. The problem of the cappuccino sales tax all over again. So how is it reasonable to call a distribution of income fair when everybody concerned, both fans and player, would prefer the unfair outcome? Thanks to Kenneth Arrow, we now know that when faced with a modern-day sports star like Tiger Woods, the solution is to levy a one-time lump-sum tax of several million dollars on him. He would still have the incentive to earn money by playing golf, since he could not avoid the tax by playing less, as he would have to do in order to avoid a heavy income tax. He would no doubt earn enough to pay off the tax bill and still retain enough to buy a family car and a nice house somewhere unassuming. In this scenario, there is no waste or inefficiency, but the result is fair in that it produces a much more even allocation of wealth. The only trouble with this plan is that it's wildly impractical. The problem is not that it's impossible to have taxes that only apply to one individual. President Franklin Roosevelt introduced an income tax rate of 79%, but the threshold was so high that the tax was paid by only John D. Rockefeller. Rather, the problem is more that a true lump-sum tax isn't supposed to change behavior at all. Ideally, it would have been decided before Tiger Woods was born, because if he could have predicted that he would be liable for a tax as a result of his success, he might have chosen a different profession. This is, of course, quite impossible, but we shouldn't abandon the Head Start theorem quite yet. While we can't always use lump-sum taxation and redistribution, we can sometimes, and when we can, it's worth considering because it preserves the efficiency and the truth of the competitive market while adding a welcome dose of fairness. A practical example. A more practical application of the Head Start theorem could be used to prevent elderly people from getting cold in winter without damaging the environment. In a typical winter in Britain, 25,000 seniors die as a result of inadequate heating. To address this concern, domestic fuel is subject to lower taxes than many other things. But that's a slightly odd way to deal with the problem, an equivalent to the running backwards solution. If governments need to raise tax revenue, and all of them do, it seems, then a first approximation of an efficient strategy would be to have the same sales tax on everything, because that wouldn't distort people's buying decisions too much. A more refined view would recall the price targeting of Chapter 2. Because customers cannot easily cut down on fuel consumption, they aren't very sensitive to the price of domestic fuel. Hence, the government should levy a bit more tax on fuel and a bit less on other goods. Customers wouldn't change their behaviour much, and so the inefficiency would be small. An even more sophisticated view, perhaps acquired from a peek ahead at Chapter 4, would note that domestic fuel is a non-renewable resource, and using it causes pollution, so the case for higher tax on domestic fuel becomes even stronger. The case for lower taxes on domestic fuel and higher taxes on other goods is hard to understand until we start to worry about the elderly shivering in front of a lifeless gas or oil furnace that they can't afford to switch on. Is this just one of those hard choices that governments sometimes have to make? Not necessarily. Instead of levying the wrong rate of tax on everyone else, better to choose a more sensible rate but give the elderly a head start, because of their poverty and because, being frail, they have an additional need for heating. The simple policy remedy is to raise fuel tax but give extra money to the elderly, money that they could use to switch that furnace on and stay warm. We know from the Head Start theorem that given the money, pensioners will find their way to the efficient outcome, which, incidentally, may not involve more fuel being burned. Not every pensioner feels cold, and those who do may find better solutions to the problem. Some may use the money to move to Florida. Some may insulate their homes. Those who did not feel the cold in the first place can spend the money on other things. Nobody will burn extra fuel unless they need to, and if they need to, they'll have the money to meet that need. The lesson of the Head Start theorem is that when a problem arises, it's worth asking whether the problem can be addressed by rearranging the starting blocks rather than interfering with the race. This strategy isn't always practical, but because free markets are efficient, it's worth trying to harness that efficiency to meet other goals. Throughout this chapter, we've been on a flight of fantasy, no more plausible than the story of Fletcher Reed. The world of truth is a world where markets are complete, free, and competitive. In reality, we're about as likely to achieve a world with complete, free, and competitive markets as hotshot lawyers are to start telling the truth to everyone. You might therefore be asking yourself why you've read a chapter, even a brief one, about some bizarre economist's fantasy. The answer is that the fantasy helps us understand why economic problems arise, and also helps us to move in the right direction. We know that a world of perfect markets combined with the Head Start approach is as good as we're going to get. When real-world economies malfunction, we know to look for the market failures, and to do our best to patch them up. We've already explored one of those failures. Some companies have scarcity power and can set prices that are far above their true cost, which is where they would be in a competitive market. This is why economists believe there's an important difference between being in favour of markets and being in favour of business, especially particular businesses. A politician who is in favour of markets believes in the importance of competition and wants to prevent businesses from getting too much scarcity power. A politician who's too influenced by corporate lobbyists will do exactly the reverse. Whether abetted by politicians or otherwise, companies with scarcity power are one market failure. There are two others. In the next two chapters, we'll encounter them, leaving the curious world of truth behind us and facing up to the real world once again. Chapter 4. Crosstown Traffic. We've just learned that in the world of perfect markets, everything is for the best. We know that perfect markets are completely efficient, delivering outcomes that are flawless.